Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 62 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 9th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we begin our month-long discussion of the second part of Henry IV with the beginning of our plot synopsis and a few introductory words and thoughts. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. Now, remember back when we were discussing the first tetralogy and the order of their composition? We thought that it might have been possible that the first part of Henry VI was actually written after the second and third parts. Well, here in this tetralogy, though, because of the dates of production and the narrative linking of the three plays we've read thus far, it's pretty much a given that they were composed in their historical order. Then Shakespeare knew he was writing a sequel when he wrote this week's play. The title of last month's play was The History of Henry IV, with the Battle of Shrewsbury between the King and Lord Henry Percy, surnamed Henry Hotspur of the North, with the humorous conceits of Sir John Falstaff. While the original title of this month's play was The Second Part of Henry IV, Concerning His Death and the Coronation of King Henry V. So, like Godfather Part II, Shakespeare knew that this was going to be a sequel. Not that I think this play outranks its predecessor in quality like the Godfather flicks do. I want you to keep this in mind this month, especially as we compare the two plays, when we consider structure, characters, expectations. Just keep it in mind. The second part of Henry IV doesn't begin with a scene with the current king, or even the next one. Instead, we get an introduction, spoken by rumor painted full of tongues. Bizarre as it sounds, it's a great opening. Open your ears, for which of you will stop the vent of hearing when loud rumor speaks? Man, is that insight into the human condition or what? Rumor goes on to discuss his worldwide state, and then presents the news from the end of the first part of Henry IV, King Harry's victory at Shrewsbury. Rumor then chides himself. But what mean I to speak so true at first? My office, to noise abroad that Harry Monmouth fell under the wrath of noble Hotspur's sword, and that the king before the Douglas's rage stooped his anointed head as low as death. Now, we've seen the battle in the previous play. This is a false report, one that brings smooth comforts false, worse than true wrongs. Now, we can only see those smooth comforts false by seeing rumor's effect on the rebels, and thus Act 1, Scene 1 takes us to Northumberland's castle. Northumberland had not attended the Battle of Shrewsbury under the excuse of illness. Now, whether this was true or he was crafty sick, as the rumor puts it, we'll never know. What we do know is that without that military support, his son Hotspur was doomed to failure and death. Northumberland waits for news in these wild times. A Lord Bardolf, not Falstaff's drinking buddy, although it is deliciously ironic that the name is shared, arrives to deliver certain news. Of course, when he delivers the report that Hotspur has slain Hal, we know it's false. Northumberland wants verification, and his servant Travers arrives with news. But Lord Bardolf says that he overrode Travers along the way. Isn't it great that rumor runs faster than the truth? Travers delivers the news, later substantiated by Morton, and Northumberland wants only blood, but not just the blood of the royals, but of everyone. It's a cataclysm of death that Northumberland wants, and he sends out his nobles to find other like-minded friends with speed. Now you'd think after such a call for rebellion, we'd next see those against whom the rebels will fight, and you'd be wrong. Instead, Act 1, Scene 2 takes us to London, where we find Falstaff and the page Prince Hal has hired for him. The old fat man makes jokes about the size of his young page by calling him giant, but his tone is somewhat serious, as he believes that Hal may keep his own grace, but he's almost out of Falstaff's. This is not the loving, caring relationship Falstaff felt for the young prince at the beginning of the last play. The tone is darker, and we'll see that it won't get much lighter. Falstaff is then accosted by the Chief Justice, a member of the King's party, accusing him of the robbery at Gad's Hill in the first part of Henry IV. The Justice's own servant, though, comes to Falstaff's defense, saying that Falstaff hath since done good service at Shrewsbury, and, as I hear, is now going with some charge to the Lord John of Lancaster. Falstaff's exploits are famous. After all, he took credit for killing Hotspur, though this is not stated explicitly here, and have brought him some leniency. It is interesting, however, that Falstaff is no longer in Hal's company. Instead, he's been assigned to Hal's brother, John. When the justice tries to bring Falstaff to account for his part in the robbery, Falstaff evades the subject with some fine comic verbal two-stepping, changing subjects from his own failing hearing, "Boy, tell him I am deaf," to the king's poor health, this same whoreson apoplexy. We get to see some of the Falstaff of the first part, quick-witted and fun, going so far as to compare his youth to the justice's old age. "You that are old, consider not the capacities of us that are young. You do measure the heat of our livers with the bitterness of your galls. And we that are in the wayward of our youth must confess are wags too." Now, it's a ridiculous statement, but it's hilarious because of its ridiculousness. The Chief Justice is flummoxed, and Falstaff delivers what he considers to be the coup de grace. He recognizes the lawman as one whom Hal gave a box on the ear. This ties into a historical legend that Hal accosted a royal lawman and was later punished for it, and thus shows Falstaff's close relationship with the prince. Only, what Falstaff considers to be his trump card, the justice can beat, as he says, "Well, the king hath severed you and Prince Harry." Falstaff is left to ponder his upcoming military campaign with John of Lancaster in Westmoreland against Northumberland, his repeated weekly wedding proposals to a heretofore unmentioned Mistress Ursula, and his old age, a pox of this gout, or a gout of this pox, as he sends Hal a letter, and the scene ends. The third and final scene of this first act takes us, again, not to the royals, but to more of the rebellion. The Archbishop of York, Richard Scroope, and Thomas Mowbray, the son of the Mowbray whose duel with Bolingbroke was interrupted by King Richard II in his play of the Tetralogy, confer with Hastings and Lord Bardolph on the best plan of action against King Henry, whom they refer to as unfirm, and militarily divided between three fronts, against them in Northumberland, against Glendower, and against the French. The time, it would seem, is ripe for rebellion. And the first act ends with King Henry and Prince Hal nowhere in sight. The second act takes us back to the tavern in Eastcheap, where Mistress Quickly is demanding that Officer Fang, another great name, no, arrest Falstaff for non-payment of his bills. What follows is a mixture of quick lays, inadvertent body references, "He stabbed me in mine own house," and "My exeon is entered and my case so openly known to the world," and Fang's not-so-inadvertent ones, "I care not for his thrust." When Falstaff enters, the officers, now accompanied by the Chief Justice, attempt to do their duty, and Falstaff tries to talk his way out of it, only to be confronted by this new accusation by Quickly. "Thou didst swear to me, then, as I was washing thy wound, to marry me and make me my lady thy wife. Can you deny it?" While Falstaff does deny it, claiming that poverty hath distracted her and made her mad, we've got to wonder if Mistress Quickly is the Mistress Ursula to whom Falstaff admitted to propose marriage to at the end of Act 1, Scene 2. There is much banter back and forth, interrupted by news that Harry, Prince of Wales, is near at hand. With such news, much is forgotten and forgiven, and even the woman who claims to have been engaged by Sir John asks if the fat man will meet with Doll Tearsheet at supper. And Doll Tearsheet, that's a great name for a whore. When Act 2, Scene 2 begins, we finally see Prince Hal talking to Poins, his robbery co-conspirator from the first part, saying that weariness discolors the complexion of his greatness to acknowledge it. Also detracting from his greatness is his thirst for small beer. This kind of conceit and desire for cheap beer, as opposed to fine ale or wine or harder liquor, is not exactly befitting the hero we saw in Hal at the end of the first part of Henry IV. And the crowd mutters, "What happened?" I'm not sure at this point, but I've got some theories, and we'll get to them, and some critical opinions as the month progresses. Anyway, Hal acknowledges this not princely desire for beer, and it sends him into a discourse on how not princely his relationship with Poynes is. What a disgrace it is to me to remember thy name, spurring him onto an almost stream of consciousness speech, moving from Poynes to the shirts he wears, to their fabric, to their use as swaddling clothes, to the midwives who deliver the babes in the swaddling clothes. And I've got to ask, is Hal drunk here? If the speech had been in verse with lofty diction, I might say that he's making a philosophical discourse on the class system in England. But it's not. He's rambling. And so if he's drunk, he's even more pathetic here than in the first part. Tempering this, though, is his own self-knowledge. He is sad that his father is sick. Is that why King Henry has been absent from class thus far in the school year? But Hal cannot show it because it will make him look like a hypocrite. You know, keeping bad company until his father is sick, and by extension, Hal is about to become king, and only then making a show of sadness. Like Hal the actor in the first part, this second part's Hal is acutely aware of how his performance will be received. Bardolph arrives with the letter that Falstaff has sent to Hal, and it is a comic mashup of self-consciously intended high language and low content. Hal asks where Falstaff is, and the answer is simple, the tavern. And that is where Hal and Poynes head. Act 2, Scene 3 takes us back to the rebels, still no Henry, where we find Northumberland readying for his military excursion. Both his wife and Lady Percy, his daughter-in-law, Hotspur's widow, want him to stay at home. His wife is resigned to his leaving. I have given over. I will speak no more. But Lady Percy, true to form from what we saw in the first part, cannot hold her tongue. She tells Northumberland that he shouldn't go to war. He didn't go to war for his son. He shouldn't now. Hotspur's death she puts squarely on the father's shoulders. And just as her words were at least somewhat successful with her husband, she is able to convince the old man to fly to Scotland until such time as rebel numbers make a battle with the king's forces, a proposition that has at least a fighting chance. The last scene of the second act takes us back to the tavern in Eastcheap, and just as the last play's Act 2, Scene 4 tavern scene is long, so is this one. Here we finally get to meet Doll Tearsheet, Falstaff's mistress. Who are we kidding? She's his whore. And she can trade body quips with Falstaff like no other, as she claims that she is meat for Falstaff. Meat that Falstaff claims make fat rascals. Ah, yes. The chubby as erect penis reference. Works through all the centuries. And you know we'll be getting into all that body stuff later in the month in the blog. The two fight. You two never meet, but you fall to some discord, is how Mistress Quickly puts it, foreshadowing much ado about nothing. There is a kind of merry war between Signor Benedict and her. They never meet, but there's a skirmish of wit between them. Yes, they fight, but there is obviously affection between the two as well. Falstaff says, "Thou dost give me flattering busses," meaning kisses, and Doll responds, "By my troth, I kiss thee with a most constant heart." It's a loving moment between the two, marred only by the mocking commentary made by Hal and Poynes from a hidden position. Using yet another reference to the first part, completing the Francis Anon bit, Hal and Poynes reveal themselves to Falstaff. What follows has banter reminiscent of the first part, but without the bounce of idle times. Here instead, Hal takes Mistress Quickly's side and demands that Falstaff pay his bills. While there are jokes, and Falstaff is still, as always, able to talk his way out of it, the tone is just not as fun. And removing any last vestige of fun is Peto's entrance with news that King Henry is in London and the army is heading north. In the last play, this news was blown off, but not here. Hal immediately admits his wrong in going back to the tavern. "I feel me much to blame so idly to profane the precious time." And note, he moves from prose to verse here. And then he tells his fat companion of old, "Falstaff, good night." And there is a feeling of finality there. Hal does not give Falstaff time to respond with his early exit. So the only farewell we see Falstaff give is to Doll, met with a tender, heartbreaking response. "If my heart be not ready to burst, well, sweet Jack, have a care of thyself." Maybe it's better to end with that goodbye than the prince's. And thus the second act ends still with the king in absentia. It is only with the beginning of Act III that we finally meet our titular king. He enters in his nightgown, sending off a page to get Surrey and Warwick. This is not what we expect a king to be. He's a sick man, and he cannot sleep. O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frighted thee, that thou wilt no more weigh my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness? He can't sleep. He can't sleep while his subjects can. Now, we might believe this to be guilt and a foreshadowing to a certain Scottish king and his wife, but it's not so much that as the cares of a king that are keeping him awake. Or as he puts it in the last line of this soliloquy, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. When Surrey and Warwick arrive and wish him good morning, Henry sounds more like Falstaff from the first part than himself. Is it good morrow, lords? He tells them a story we saw two plays ago. Richard II warning that Northumberland would one day turn against Henry. Warwick dismisses Richard's statement as a perfect guess. Henry fears that Northumberland's army has grown to over 50,000. Now, as we know from Act 2, Scene 3, Northumberland has fled to Scotland. And it seems that Warwick knows this too, as he tells the king that rumor doth double, like voice and echo, the numbers of the feared. Ah, that rumor again. This soothes Henry, who still dreams of a voyage to the Holy Land. Act 3, Scene 2 takes us to Gloucestershire, where we meet the justices Shallow and Silence, and some of the country soldiers from their lands. And for a sequel, it is amazing how many new characters we meet for the first time in this play. Unlike the first part's King Henry, who despairs over his son's time in the tavern, Shallow speaks with pride of his cousin William, a good scholar, at Oxford. Shallow and Silence then begin to reminisce about their younger days, when they knew where the bona robis were and had the best of them at all commandment. They were skirt chasers, and so was one Jack Falstaff, now Sir John, a boy and page to Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk. Isn't it interesting that Falstaff was a page to Thomas Mowbray, the man with whom Henry Bolingbroke quarreled at the beginning of Richard II? Could this be an old grudge and loyalty to his former master that pushes Falstaff to corrupt Prince Hal? It's an interesting concept. And at this point, who should arrive but the fat old man himself? And the old friends become reacquainted in prologue to Falstaff's pressing into military service some of the locals. We watch as he goes through the motley crew, comically commenting on each, much to the enjoyment of the two men. As the three think back to their youth, "We have heard the chimes at midnight," Falstaff tells them. Bardolph accepts bribes from some of the men to buy them out of military service. Once his friends have left, and Bardolph has taken the new, poorer recruits away, Falstaff is left alone on stage. He tells us, "Lord, Lord, how subject we old men are to this vice of lying." And then he goes on to tell a number of ridiculous stories himself, concluding, "Let time shape, and there an end." And there an end to Act 3 as well, and to this week's portion of the plot synopsis. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Part 2, And It Begins, Rumor Rebels and a Fat Old Man, Our Titular King is Still Missing in Action, and The Chimes at Midnight. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 9th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.